Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. John Farrow and Tom Keene, we welcome all of you, particularly on SiriusXM in Texas and in the district of the Federal Reserve System of Texas. With us, Robert Kaplan. He is president and the chief executive officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. One of the high points for my year was our extended conversation at the Council on Foreign Relations. Also, one of the high points of my year was when Michael McKee was given the honor of final questions to Chair Yellen and insulted the chair by asking her which dot was her. Did you ask President Kaplan of Dallas which dot was his?
I did, actually. We'll do it again.
Do it again.
Because, you know, the idea of how many rate increases from the Fed next year is paramount in everybody's mind on Wall Street. So why don't we start with that? Oddly, for some reason, Rob Kaplan has always been a longtime fan of Bloomberg Surveillance. So maybe he'll let us get away with this. It's one of the strange
things. Because my father darkened the door of a small college in College Station, Texas, where there were no girls at the time.
Anyway, leaving all that aside, where is your dot? And do you think three rate moves in 2018 is a reasonable assumption?
Well, and I said to you, we've talked before, gradual and patient is my key comment. My own dot was three. Whether it'll turn out that way, we'll have to see. And what would change? The economy could grow faster than I expect. We could make more progress on unemployment. Inflation might cause me to be higher than three. Or the 10-year Treasury is something I'll be watching. And what the 10-year does will also influence how many rate increases next year.
Because the yield curve is flattening.
Yield curve is something I'll be watching carefully. So that could augur the other way.
The yield curve's flattening, and I wonder whether what the signal really is there, because most people would say there's a massive balance sheet over at the ECB, there's a massive balance sheet over at the BOJ, and that's why we've got this flattening, that's why the 10-year yield's not rising. Do you see anything in that? Does that argument resonate with you?
So it's a part of it, and by the way, I wish that was all of it, but my own view is a part of what's going on is global liquidity, but I think the bigger part of why the 10-year is muted is sluggish expectations for out-year GDP growth. And what I mean by that, if you look at what potential GDP growth is 5 years from now, I think it is actually declining from where we are today. Why is that happening? Aging demographics, slowing workforce growth, and sluggish productivity, unless the United States improves early childhood literacy, college readiness, and middle skills training. So I think the 10-year Treasury tells you more about expectations for future growth, which are sluggish. And so if you told me we were going to have solid GDP growth the next 2 or 3 years trailing off to maybe below 2% 5 years from now, I would have expected a flattish yield curve, and that's what you're seeing.
But you expect the need to address structural issues from your response just there. So what's the Fed's role in this?
Fed has a part in this, but not all of it. And I've been a big advocate of saying monetary policy is going to be a key part of economic policy the next 5 years. But structural reforms, we're at the stage where we need structural reforms. What do I mean? Regulatory review is a good thing. The elements of the tax bill that involve corporate tax reform, I think, are constructive. We'll come back to the rest of it. I think beefing up education, we are lagging in this country in terms of educational attainment. It's hurting productivity. And lastly, middle skills training is going to be essential, particularly in an economy where technology-enabled disruption is accelerating. And I think we're lagging in those areas.
You talk about the 10-year as an indicator of the market's view of long-term potential growth. That is completely different than the man down in Washington who seems to think the tax cut is going to change the whole fundamental picture for the United States. Is the market wrong or is the president wrong?
So let me answer it this way. I've been in the markets my entire adult life and been watching them since I was before I was an adult. And what I learned is I don't always know what the market is saying, but I know it always pays attention to try to decipher what it's saying. And I think the market is saying, the bond market is saying, expectations for future growth are sluggish. And I think it's worth paying attention to that.
We know Chairman Powell's not listening this morning. He's at the dentist getting a root canal. I believe on Kris Kringle, you're going to be giving the gift that keeps on giving to Jerome Powell. And that would be, I know what you told me what you're going to buy. You're going to get him a copy of What You Really Need to Lead, your heart, your wonderful book. You no doubt bought it off Amazon. Chapter 4, You Can't Do This Alone, Learning to Build Relationships and Harness the Power of a Group. Baloney. There were two dissents. Every chairman's different.
Yeah.
What do you presume will be the method of Governor Powell as he becomes chairman?
So the good thing, Jay Powell is outstanding. I've been working together with him for more than 2 years. He's been on the Fed board for a number of years. And the most important thing, and I think Jay will be a great leader for this, is debate, disagreement, and to extend humanly possible, a lack of politics. And I think Jay will take that approach.
Give us a window of what happens at that long wooden table.
So here's what happens. We meet on Monday in D.C., and we normally have committee meetings. The FOMC starts on Tuesday, and we sit around the table. Each of us talks for 10 minutes and gives our views of the economy, and we debate it out on day one. That's Tuesday. And on Wednesday, we each, for 10 minutes, give our view on monetary policy. The chair goes last, as they do on Tuesday, and the chair goes last. We debate that out, and then in the last 13 seconds of the meeting, we vote. And so the nice thing about the FOMC process, the Federal Open Market Committee process, is we debate, we disagree, and if someone in the room says something, regardless of who they are, and I don't agree with it, I'm going to raise my hand, and vice versa. And we're each trying to listen carefully, learn, and add insight. And so I think it's a pretty healthy dynamic.
So the man from Minneapolis turns around on Wednesday afternoon and says to you guys, no. No, because there's a message in the bond market to slow down. You guys should slow down. What do you say back to the man from Minneapolis?
So I think the nice thing, and I think it's excellent, I think it's a good thing that we have disagreement, we have people willing to dissent. You got to remember, we've been debating around the table each of our views. So what happens in the last 13 seconds of the meeting when we vote is not a surprise. We already know each other's views, and we debate them out, and we disagree. Some of the disagreements get resolved, and some go unresolved. And I think that's a good thing.
If you
my rebuttal, though, just so you know, is I believe we need to take a balanced approach to monetary policy. I'm more of a centrist. That means you look at the degree of the full employment overshoot, which I think is going to be substantial in 2018. You look at the degree of the inflation undershoot, which I've been a big advocate of saying part of it is cyclical, but bigger part of it is structural. And when I weigh those two, I think we'd be well served here to remove accommodation, because what you don't want to do is wait too long to where you're playing catch up.
Michael, get one last one in here. Not on the Denver Broncos.
Or the Dallas Cowboys. Neither one having a season to remember. Uh-huh.
Although Cowboys getting a little better.
Well, so are the Broncos. We'll debate that outside the studio.
All right.
Back to that debate, though. You say we get a substantial overshoot or undershoot in terms of unemployment rate. You got a number for that?
No, I mean the full employment, what is a theoretical level, we'll know it in hindsight. Mm-hmm. But our judgment, the Dallas Fed, is we're either there or we're under it. Here's the number I look at. I like to look not at the unemployment rate. I look at U6, as we've mentioned before. Unemployed plus discouraged workers plus people working part time for economic reasons is 8%. The pre-recession low, we're basically at the pre-recession low. That's the number I watch.
Quickly. Does the tax legislation make the American economy more Texas-like?
Here's the positive of this legislation. I think corporate tax reform, incentives for people to locate their businesses in the United States, are positive. I think one of the positives of Texas, why people are coming, it's a very attractive place to locate your business, and a lot of other things, no state tax, et cetera. The part that I'm concerned about is the part that's a tax cut financed by increasing the deficit makes a problem that's already unsustainable more challenging. Well, and that's my concern.
Robert Kaplan, thank you so much. Michael McKee, thank you so much as well. Dr. Kaplan,
thank you,
of course,
guys,
with the Dallas Fed as well. John Farrow and Tom Keynes, this is Bloomberg. And now for the Minneapolis Fed, the dissenter, Neil Kashkari. Neil, wonderful to have you with us this morning. Is there a distinction between your dissent and that of the dissent of Mr. Evans of Chicago, or are they saying the same thing?
First of all, Tom, nice to chat with you. Thanks for having me. I think Charlie Evans and I are probably in the same place. We're both worried about low inflation and low inflation expectations and the risk that that could become anchored in the economy and how difficult that is to deal with if it does become anchored.
Neil, why is there a message in the bond market this time around when there are such big balance sheets at the ECB and BOJ keeping a lid on long-term yields? Why do you still see a message in the yield curve?
Well, I think the fact that, I agree, term premiums are low now. And so some people say, well, this is different because of the big QEs and the balance sheets that are out there. But the fact that the long end of the curve is not responding to our rate increases and not responding to the tax cut package that has now come together, I think there is information contained in that. I mean, even if the QEs are still having some effect, I would still expect to see some movement in the long end of the curve in response to this new information. The fact that it's not, and we're, in my opinion, we're sending a very hawkish signal by raising rates at a time of low and seemingly falling inflation, I think the Fed is responsible for pushing up the front end and keeping a lid on the back end.
So, Neil, going forward, I just wonder what this means for policy. Is the message in the yield curve recession risk? Because most people would say it's not that. Is the message slow down? Is that what you're taking away from it? Slow down or recession risk?
I think it's, look, it could be both. I mean, you know, every time somebody says this time is different, they usually end up regretting saying that because it ends up, you know, the future looks more like history than we recognize at the time, number one. Number two, the fact is, if the bond market is telling us that they've got low inflation expectations or they're pricing in a low neutral real interest rate, a low R star, as we call it, both of those should be telling us, hey, we should be cautious about raising interest rates further until we actually see the inflationary pressures building. You know, when I first dissented in March, I was just saying, I don't see any inflationary pressures building. Why are we raising rates? What's happened since then? Inflation has actually fallen, not gone up. I think we should take these signals seriously.
Neil, each voice is distinctive. You are the engineer at the Fed. 20 years ago, you were in the acclaimed Sun Race 97, which was an intercollegiate solar car race. Illinois, I believe, did better than good within that race. Is there physics envy at the Fed? Do you look around, you know, from a Newtonian standpoint of where you are, do you look around at people being too mathy, too certain in their physics versus what you observe within the economy?
Well, I do think there's some of that. And I think I've described it as a tension between faith and data. I think there's some folks who have tremendous faith in the Phillips curve that this is the way the economy works. Labor markets get tight, wages go up, that leads to inflation, versus looking at the data. And I keep coming back to what is the data actually telling us? And we're trying to assess supply and demand in the labor market. If you want to assess supply and demand in a market, let's start by looking at the price. What is the price telling us? Well, we know that wage growth is not accelerating. We've been expecting it to accelerate, but it's not accelerating. That tells me there's probably still more slack in the labor market, and that's why we're not seeing these pressures building.
Neil, do you have any idea on how much lower unemployment can go? Because we're in the low fours. You're looking for something in the low threes?
Well, I think that number is probably somewhat distorted right now, because if you look at prime age labor force participation, so workers roughly 25 to 55, there are still more than a million workers on the sidelines if you look at labor force participation and employment to population ratios. Now, can all million be brought back in? I don't know. But it does seem to be that there's more slack in the labor market than that headline unemployment rate suggests. I mean, what we're learning is that the Great Recession was so destructive to the labor market. Some of these measures are a little bit broken right now. The measures themselves seem to be flawed right now.
a lot of people are criticizing you, Mr. Kashkari, because you're looking simplistically at the dynamics of the yield curve. In your essay on the Minneapolis Fed website, you go right to it and you say, what is new is the flattening yield curve. Is it new in the recent months, or is it new in Fed history that we're getting these odd fixed income dynamics?
No, it's new recently. I mean, we've seen flattening yield curves before. We saw it in the mid-2000s. We saw it in the late 1990s. And by the way, look at both of those periods. In the late 90s and in the mid-2000s, the stock market was rocketing. So I don't take any comfort from the fact that the yield curve is flattening and the stock market is rocketing, because it's done it in the past and the bond market was right and the stock market was wrong. And I'm not predicting a recession. I'm simply saying inflation is low. It's been falling this year. Why are we in such a rush to go raise rates? Why not actually allow that inflation to reveal itself? We have very powerful tools to deal with high inflation. We have very limited tools to deal with low inflation.
So, Neil,
so why are we jumping the gun?
The pushback will be financial distortions, negative yielding debt north of $9 trillion worldwide. There's a trade-off here, and it's a trade-off over about 50 basis points on PCE. If you wait for inflation to get up towards 2%, financial distortions are going to get even bigger. Are you not sensitive to the trade-off between what's happening in financial markets and what might happen with PCE?
Well, this goes back to, and I wrote a long piece on my website about this, this goes back to using interest rates to try to deal with a stock market bubble and how costly that is. In 1996, as you both know, Alan Greenspan declared that we had irrational exuberance. If he had used monetary policy to try to stop the stock market from rising, I think that would have been much more costly to the economy and to workers than the actual correction that took place in 2000 and the fairly mild recession that followed. So to me, we have to look out for financial stability risks like 2008. Yeah. The tech bubble bursting was not a financial stability event.
Neil Kashkari, thank you so much. Greatly appreciated. He is president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Greatly appreciate his attendance today. That's pretty good, John. Kaplan and Kashkari.
That's quite a morning.
That's quite a morning. Thank you to Michael McKee. This is Bloomberg. This is a joy and an honor. He is out of Purdue and Penn State. His name is William Hoagland. And his experience in Washington with Alice Rivlin at CBO a few years ago, and with Senators Frist of Tennessee, Senator Domenici as well, has been extraordinary. And he is deeply experienced in the realities of tax legislation. William Hoagland is a very important voice at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. I'm going to give you an open question, Bill, because you've got such experience, breadth, and depth. As you look at the different scenarios, the analysis of the last 3 or 4 days, what's the thing that sticks out to you in this website, and that website?
Well, first of all, thank you. You're very kind with your introductions, Tom. What stands out to me, I guess, as I look at this is the fact that the American public, in terms of polling on this particular piece of legislation, seems to be somewhat negative, that they perceive it as a mostly a benefit to the upper income and corporate America, and no benefit to them. And I see this as juxtaposed up against a president who says this is a cut for the middle, this is a reduction in taxes for middle class, it will grow the economy, and the benefits are strained. So there seems to be a real disconnect between what Congress is doing and what the American public believe this legislation will do.
I'm assuming William Hoagland's going to tell us there's gray in the middle. Well, where's the gray? Is it towards the president or is it towards our listeners?
Well, I think that that's a very good question. I think it's gray. I think there are first of all, when you look at what is likely to happen when this is enacted, and as I understand, the Secretary Mnuchin and the Treasury Department are moving, and IRS is moving to change the withholding tables so that they will have an impact upon 2019. 2018 withholding. It should be some benefits there. When you look at the legislation, it does have reductions across the board, it seems. Now, some people will benefit, some people won't, but overall, there will be a reduction in average tax take out there from the American public. However, the big problem is, as I see it, is that a number of these, and particularly the rate cuts and the child care credits and things that the middle class America are looking for, go away in 2025. And yet the corporate tax cuts and the other larger tax cuts are for business continue on. So there is what I'm afraid this legislation is not going to unite the American public. I think it will continue to divide us and continue to add to the polarization that seems to be somewhat rather pervasive throughout the country today.
Bill, I want to dig into the polarization and maybe draw a distinction between perception and reality. On the perception, is this a communication problem with this administration? Have they sold this plan badly over the last couple of months?
Listen, I believe that we need a tax reform. I believe the president and the administration and Republican, I believe Democrats believe that we need tax reform. I think what's been done, where they missed on this is, and I no surprise coming from the bipartisan policy center where I work today, that I think it would have been a much more acceptable plan had Republicans chose not to go the route of in using what we call the budget reconciliation process that requires them to only have a simple majority in the Senate to pass it. Like the 1986 tax reform bill was done in a bipartisan way, and it had sustainability in it. I think this particular legislation will have, for Republicans, it will be similar to what President Obama had with the Affordable Care Act, where it was not passed with any Republican support, only Democratic support. Now we have legislation only passing with Republican support. That means, from my perspective, we're going to be debating tax reform all the way through the next midterm and into the presidential election.
Bill Hoglund, I want you to take this out to your Purdue and to Lafayette, zip code 47909. Good morning, Purdy Materials. You got a concrete company out in western northern Illinois, south of Gary, where Purdue is. I get it, okay? Purdy Materials, what does this mean to a normal small business? Not some real estate tycoon on Fifth Avenue. What does it mean to a company like Purdy Materials?
Well, I do think that the pass-through changes, that the changes in the pass-through of the S Corporation, I think the reductions there, I do think that there is a benefit to some of the smaller businesses and small business out there, the individuals and entrepreneurship. I do think that that is positive. I also think generally that as we get into this and we start to see the implementation of it and individuals maybe see a little bit more in their take-home pay, that will benefit those individuals working for that particular company in northern Indiana and has some benefit. So I think the issue here is it will be beneficial. It should be beneficial in the short term. Whether it sustains I still think it's positive.
We'll have to see. Bill Hoglund. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.